Following program contains geeks using geek language. You have been warned.
This is the Dungeon Master Guys. Dungeon Master Guys.
Hey everyone, and welcome to our historic first episode of the Dungeon Master Guys podcast. Who are the Dungeon Master Guys? Well, there's me, Phil, the Chat EDM from Musings of the Chat EDM, and there's Dave the Game. Hey, Dave.
Hey.
Dave is owner of the very well-known Critical Hits blog, and we've got Newbie DM. Hey, Newbie.
Hey, Phil. Hey, Dave. How are you guys doing?
All right, and Newbie DM is, of course, the writer for the newbiedm.com blog. All right, what is the DM Guys podcast about? It's pretty simple. It's a focused show. It's not going to be too long, about 30 minutes, and it's going to be all about DMing, made by DMs and for DMs. It's going to be talking about D&D. It's going to share opinions, advice. We're going to answer questions, and all of this will be focused on two or three segments in each show. We'll also have occasional guests, either from the industry or from the online gaming community. Guys, are you ready to start the show?
I am. Let's go.
All right. So, why don't we start with Dave's segment? What is it going to be about today?
I'm going to take this opportunity to inflict information about my campaign on the whole world on our very first podcast here by telling you about my campaign, how I prep for it, what tools I use, and one of the adventures that I planned recently.
So, well, I'm pretty sure you don't actually prep your campaign, so I can't wait to hear that.
What's prep?
Well, go ahead.
So way back when I was a fledgling DM, back in the Halcyon 2nd Edition days, I used notebooks, regular school notebooks, because I was in middle school and high school. Of course, those notebooks were filled with information about my world, my villains. My villain, by the way, back then was Dorton Vader and his 12 penetrators. I've come a little bit farther since then. But that was my main vector for ideas. If I was sitting in class, I had an idea, I wanted to sketch a map, I'll go in these notebooks and would end up in, you know, 5 or 6 different notebooks and I'd lose stuff, but it would get down on paper. This continued all the way through high school and through college as I would plan my game when I was tuning out in class. I seem to have lost my drawing ability, and I've always had horrendous handwriting, so I don't do that as much anymore. I've largely moved to electronic tools. Aside from the benefits of cut and paste, it also means that I have the information at my fingertips no matter where I'm at and where inspiration strikes. For a long time, I was using Google Docs. Google Docs is very lightweight, and if you combo it with Chrome in the compendium, you can copy monsters and items into Google Docs, and it'll keep all the formatting intact, which kind of helps it stay organized, which you lose some of that information when you paste it as plain text. Lately, I've been doing a lot of it in Google Wave, since I do a lot of collaboration in my game. My friend Bartonius, who writes for Critical Hits as well, is running another campaign in the same campaign world in the future, so it's often important for him to see what I'm planning so that can influence what he's planning to do for his game in the future, and at the same time, I get ideas when I see how his games have run. So no matter what medium I'm using, I use outlines. When I first start, I just put down the major plot beats. There are things that I want to cover, particularly important bits of fluff, NPC names. If it's important, it goes into the outline first. And then while the outlining is happening, or after it's done, depending on how solid the idea is in my head, I start to plan encounters. This often involves a trip to the compendium again, because once I start looking at monsters, it can give me ideas there. I'm also a big bits guy, so I find myself digging through my minis, looking for that inspiration as well. You know, if I see some fire creatures that I haven't used in my campaign yet, like, oh, I'll throw them in a volcano. I also will look through my dungeon tiles and see if there's something neat I can put together from that, and that might give me an idea. Or even just flipping through poster maps, you know, whatever I have as far as supplies for the game, these can inspire scenes that I can drop into the game later, or it'll, you know, some combination of plot beat and bit will click together, and then I have an idea. Once my outline and rough encounter ideas are generated, I'll paste the monster stat blocks together to generate actual encounters, you know, with the appropriate amount of monsters and that kind of thing. If I'm running with a laptop, they're going to stay in there, but otherwise I'll warp them to a page, print them out, have them at my disposal. So this gives me overall a rough adventure idea to work with, but it's not done there because I'll likely go back and revise it several times before the adventure starts. I'll be driving and some added plot twist will come up and I'll have to put that in or remember something that I wanted to do in a future adventure and decide, oh, this is the time to spring that, so I'll slide that in. This process continues until I actually run my adventure. Some of the best ideas I've had have been literally minutes before I get to the game, you know, if I'm driving to a friend's house to play or waiting for people to arrive. So as an example of all this, let me tell you about the previous adventure I ran. During it, I tried out this program Master Plan that had been recommended to me. It's designed for planning and running 4E games, and it's still kind of outline-based like I like, and was using it as an experiment. Plus, this adventure was a little bit tricky. So the initial concept that I had been working with for a while was that the PCs have a time machine, and they are using it to travel back to the days of ancient Nerath to retrieve a book that contains information about their nemesis, the Chain God. What I came up with a little bit later was that I wanted it to be a Groundhog Day-style loop where they would start, you know, going through the day and it would go pretty normally. Maybe some things would go wrong. They get to the end of the day and the day would start over again, and the adventurer is actually just trying to escape that loop along with the book that they seek. So I put the ideas in Wave and got some feedback, especially because it's the past of Danny's game, too. So the stuff with Ancient Nerath heavily involved the stuff that he might be planning. So he gave me some of his ideas back and went back and forth. And so then I started outlining some of the major beats. The book itself would be extremely difficult to find in the massive library. The library is eventually going to catch fire and burn down, an army of gnolls and demons on the way, the time machine needs fixing, all sorts of stuff is going wrong. Because it's a Groundhog Day adventure, they have to deal with all of these things to be able to escape. You know, they can't just let it go by in the background. That was the initial idea of the adventure and then some of the major things that would be there. So with all that in mind, I started looking through the compendium for appropriate monsters in the level range. This is an adventure that I didn't necessarily need any combat encounters, but depending on what the PCs were going to do, I wanted to have some of those prepared in case that's the way they wanted to go as an option, but not as, you know, there are things they have to fight. The first thing I looked at were Warforged. They make sense because I established them as warriors in Ancient Nerath, but the party had fought some Warforged recently, so I thought that was kind of old and decided to move on. Then I found these black and white Slatty, and the thought occurred to me, what if the Slad were the chaotic defenders of the time stream, these sort of weird creatures that show up out of nowhere to correct holes in the time-space continuum? It was also kind of inspired by an episode of Doctor Who where there were these weird Reaver creatures that also performed that role. So that all kind of clicked and said, okay, instead of just doing this existing Groundhog Day style, every full day repeats thing, what if when the PCs make disturbances in time, these giant toads come out of nowhere and send them back to the beginning of the day until they're not messing up the day anymore? They are protecting the time stream by forcing the players to not mess things up. Instantly, the adventure became much more dynamic and interesting to me. I've run Groundhog Day adventures 4 times now, and this makes it all new. Plus, some of my players had been in 1 or 2 of those previous style adventures, so this let them experience something new with it, and I looked for something new with it. So while this, in the course of searching for monsters, I also spotted a level 21 Baelor, kind of like a weakened Baelor, that I decided would be fun to throw along with a Gnoll army, because they wouldn't necessarily fear a bunch of Gnolls at the level they're at, but when they hear they have a Baelor with them, it becomes a bit more serious. I also kind of threw together, you know, just a bunch of guards, these elite guards. Normally at mid-Paragon, it seems kind of silly to fight the town guard or whatever, But it just made sense to sort of have that ready in case, you know, they started really pressing on things. So using Master Plan, I made the outline, adding all these different kind of bubbles for each step, and I gave each one a time during the day so I knew what would happen in what order. I set 6 a.m., like Groundhog Day, is the when they arrive, and I also wrote some box text that I would read out loud whenever they repeated the day. I added the encounters to the appropriate bubbles, and from there, I pretty much had my adventure. This one in particular, I couldn't really predict where they were going to go, and indeed, when I actually ran it, they were pretty creative and went a lot of places I didn't expect them to, and so I didn't put a lot more into it than the outline. If there were more adventures where I knew they would be in at least some places, I might try to plan out some branches and that kind of thing, but in this, I just stuck with an outline. And that was my adventure, and I thought it went well. And that's pretty much it. So if you have any questions about prepping, any questions about any of the tools I talked about, anything else, you can reach me at dave@critical-hits.com or all of the three of the hosts here at dmg@critical-hits.com. Thanks for listening.
So that's how I prep my game. What do you guys think?
You know, I've gone through, ever since I started DMing, I've gone through, maybe I've reinvented myself as a DM like maybe 5 or 6 times about how I prep my game. You know, I've gone from digital tools to pen and paper to using the internet to prepping with the software I use to run my combats. I enjoy prepping and I enjoy finding new ways to prep, so I'm always changing the way I do things at the table.
You know, Dave, I've always tried to do prep using outlines and sticking to outlines and not going too far off them and just leave room for improv. And yet I always finish doing too much. I always end up doing too much, writing a whole adventure with all kinds of details and too much fluff that I could basically hand off the adventure to someone else and it could run it. But someday I'll reach your level of zen.
Yeah, it really depends on if you know your group, you know, because the more you prep, the more chances are that your players will go off what you've prepped, I think. But if you know that your players are probably going to stay in the area or you're writing all those things, you know, it's just depends on style and knowing your players. So, Newbie, I hear you've got something to tell us about your players.
Well, the thing is that, you know, we have the group I play with. We're a bunch of guys my age. We're in our 30s. We have families and we have kids and all that good stuff. So our playtime is very limited. We don't get to play once a week like we wish we could. Sometimes we don't get to play once every 2 weeks like we wish we could. So we make the best of what we have with the time we have. So I was thinking about, you know, people playing characters from 1st through 30th level playing the same character, and I thought, you know what, that's a ridiculous concept. When people are trying to play new characters and new try out all the new classes that Wizards is pumping out. So I prepared this, you know, my thoughts on the subject. So why don't we listen in?
In the Great Hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's 4 greatest heroes. Created from the cosmic legends.
You guys remember
of the
that from the old Super Friends cartoon?
Superman.
The Hall of Justice, where all the heroes would basically hang out until the bad guys would show up. Well, how about carrying that concept onto your D&D table in order to satisfy the needs of those players that enjoy playing different races and classes in your game? Recently here at home, we finished a module, and one of my players said, "Well, now I'm going to bring in a Dragonborn Sorcerer." And another player chimed in with, "What do you mean another character? What is this, musical chairs? What happened to playing your guy all the way through?" Well, at that point, I couldn't help but jump in and ask, "What's the big deal if he wants to bring in another character? Who are we to keep him from having fun?" The way I see it, I can't allow either another player or myself to keep someone from having fun at the table. If the guy wants to change characters around every now and then so be it. We aren't power gamers that get to play once a week. At best, we play every other week for about 4 hours at a time. Admittedly, it's not a lot. So if a guy wants to swap characters in and out, so be it. I don't mind. I figure the best way to do this is to create a pool of characters. During character creation, have your players roll up 3 or 4 different characters each, which they'll keep in their back pocket for future use. You as a DM can have all these characters be part of the same adventuring company, and when some characters aren't being used, they can be assumed to be off on other adventures. Maybe you can even advance your B-plot through them off-camera, and have the currently active PCs deal with them as NPCs. This way, you can level all the characters at the same time and explain the level gain as the levels that they earned when they were adventuring off-camera. Now, the first drawback that I see here is the treasure allotment, and admittedly, you're going to have to do some tweaking here. Perhaps by assigning the heroes level-appropriate gear every time that they reappear on the scene and explain it away just like you do with the level gain. Or perhaps the adventurers have an armory in their Hall of Justice that they can tap into and equip themselves whenever it is they go out in search of the unknown. So there you go. Satisfy your players' need for variety with this idea. Especially so if your playing time is so limited that they'll never get to sample the multitude of combinations offered by the now 3-player handbooks out there for 4th edition D&D. Let's go back now to the DM's table with Chatty and Dave.
So there you go. I compare my party to the Super Friends in their Hall of Justice. What do you think about that?
It's interesting because my game, I've got 10 players, not all of whom play at the same time. I split them into 2 groups. But so something like that wouldn't really work for me, but I try to allow pretty liberal retraining. Or if you tell me you want your character dead to play a new one, I'll make that happen. But it, too, kind of feels like, you know, the Hall of Justice effect where, oh, here's, you know, 5 different classes for this adventure, but they're actually all backed by players instead of your game where it would be 1 player moving between them.
I just have a hard time saying no to someone who's telling me, hey, listen, I want to play the new class that came out when barely play.
Yeah, and I mean, and that was one of my driving decisions when we started playing 4E. During 3.5, we kept buying books that players wanted to use, but we were playing those campaigns that lasted 2 years or more. So when we started playing 4E, especially for the first level 1 to level 30 round trip, I guess, was to play just mini campaigns. We decided to play mini campaigns of 6 to 8, maybe 10 sessions each, which would cover a few levels. And once that was done, the story arc would end, and players would decide if we stayed in the same world, we would decide if we kept the characters or made new ones. And we would forward the time enough so that it made sense and the characters settled down and then picked up weapons again and their, you know, their powers and whatnot and started adventuring again. And it works fine. And every 10 or 12 sessions or so, or 15, we get bored of the setting and we create a new setting. And you know, my players have been loving it, and I've been loving it, and, like, we already have Player's Handbook 3 classes starting as of the next game.
I know you've been playing with mini campaigns, because I've been reading, you know, in your blog, the Gears of Ruin and all that good stuff you plan for your games, and you've also taken chunks from another game and added it to your 4E game, specifically Mouse Guard.
Oh, yeah.
How's that going for you?
Oh, yeah, it was an epiphany. Reading about that game, and that's basically what I decided to make my segment about, using Mouse Guard's failure system to get failures in D&D to be more interesting, especially failures for skills. Today I'd like to talk to you about something that's been on my mind, role-playing-wise, for quite a few months, and it's failures. Those who've been following my antics on the blog have noticed that I've been exploring different ways of managing failures, not so much failures at the table between players and GM, although that would be a great subject for a later show, but mostly about failures in the game and especially focused on skills. Now, this nerd obsession probably started when I read Mouse Guard last summer. I bought it based on the recommendations of many gamers, and I was completely stunned at the quality of the writing and the elements that I had never been exposed to as a role player and a game master in the last 25 years. And one of those elements, one of the most defining element of the game that I really latched on, was how failures were handled in Mouse Guard. The way it works is that Mouse Guard adventure is usually a mission.
where a group of mice need to do a series of tasks. And they're very simple tasks, and usually escort or pathfinding or bringing an item somewhere. And all of these scenes can be boiled down into just one skill check. Now, a leader decides to roll the skill check, and other players help out, and there's a narrative built around that. And once the skill check is rolled, well, two things can happen, right? If there's a success, we move on to the next scene. That's it. The player, the winning player gets to narrate what happens, and everybody's happy. And in fact, if players ace all their skill checks, the adventure is done in about 20 minutes, and that's it for the evening. But actually, the game really starts being interesting is when the players start to fail. Because when they fail a skill check, what really happens is that the players relinquish narrative control back to the game master, and the game master is allowed to put a the game master adds whatever complication he wants to add to the game. Something happens to the players, to the PCs, that they have no control over. So they get lost, they get ambushed, they get one of the PCs falls into a river and follows the current while the other two have to start running after them. And this creates a twist in the plot that deviates the players from their goals. That was really interesting because actually the more players fail, the more exciting the adventure gets, and the more rewards the players got. But each and every of those failures were not dead-end failures. They were failures where the players had to work just a little bit harder to get back on track on their adventure. Now, that got me thinking. If we focus on D&D, and especially the 4th edition, but that would work for the 3rd edition too, skills are usually used for knowledge checks or to do pinpoint, open the door or disarm the trap effects, or are integrated in a more complex, formal system in the skill challenges. But I've grown somewhat unsatisfied with skill challenges as written, as many other players are, because they're kind of hard to understand or grok. Sometimes it feels pretty arbitrary to stop a challenge after three failures and whatnot. So I've been thinking about adapting Mouse Guard's system to D&D, and I came up with something I call a skill scene. Now, the way I use it is I would plan an adventure for a normal D&D adventure, giving goals to PCs and my majors and minor quests, and I would probably use a dungeon, or it could be a city adventure or a wilderness adventure, and the actual map of the adventure becomes a flowchart, and each arrow would link scenes or areas that players would need to visit to complete their quests. And whatever they do in each scene, depending on what I describe or how they travel from one scene to the other, could become a skill scene, which I would ask the players, okay, so what are you doing to go from point A to point B with the info I gave you? And someone would come forward, describe to me what they do, and I would set the DC, easy, medium, or hard, and have them roll a skill check. Now, if they succeed, they do exactly what they want, which is great. But if they fail, now, instead of using the old, the old tropes of D&D, which means that a failure means that you get a dead end, or you're not able to do what you want to achieve, I would tell them, oh, you can achieve what you want. You failed, but you can achieve what you want. But here's a twist. So the easiest one, and maybe the most boring one in D&D, is if they want to move from point A to point B in the forest, and they miss their group stealth check, well, they disturb a group of sleeping gnolls, and the gnolls got up, and they're kind of angry and hungry, so maybe a fight will start. And then you start another scene, and now you deal with the gnolls, and then you start another scene, maybe it's a chase. So your adventure basically becomes a tree of decision tree, where whatever happens at each corner, the players make a choice. They call a course of action, and whether they succeed or fail, you will move the story maybe improv, like a little bit more improv that you've been used to, through a tree of possible outcomes. This allows the player to feel that they've got much more control on the game because they get to choose stuff based on the info you give them, and they'll see that success goes into a certain direction, but failure, instead of becoming, okay, well, this roll just failed, let's just go back and roll again or do something else, well, they'll be in trouble. They'll need to react. They'll need to take other decisions, and maybe they'll go down a path that will put them in more in worse trouble, or it'll save their bacon if they pull it out with a good roll later on, or a brilliant idea that gives them a huge bonus. The basic idea of this thing, what I call the series of skill checks, or skill scenes, I mean, is that by the end of your adventure, your group will basically have written what happened. And you can use the number of success, total number of success, or total number of failures to gauge how the adventure went. For example, instead of using... And in fact, if you step away from what I just described, the whole adventure becomes a skill challenge. It's just that you didn't write it as such at the beginning, and you didn't create a series of skill lists. But when you look at it and you can start gauging successes and failures, well, maybe after each X number of failures, something happens to the group that's really bad, like the bad guy moves and sends all his men, or something crushes or is destroyed in the dungeon and there's a cave-in and the players are stuck in it, and then you move on and you continue with your skill checks, and if they score another 3 failures, well, something other really bad happens, and maybe at a certain point, you know, the players get the hint and leave the dungeon. So, that's an approach I propose to look at D&D games, and I've been using it in my Gears of Ruin campaign so far, and it's been working great. In fact, it worked so well that my players didn't notice that I was actually having them go through a kind of skill challenge. So, let me know how it works if you ever want to try it, and I hope you like this part of this segment of our new show. And if you've got any questions, don't hesitate to leave comments in the comment section, or send me an email at chatedm@critical-its.com. That's chatedm@critical-its.com. So, guys, this is my proposal to add what I call skill scenes into a D&D 4E. What are your thoughts?
I've been looking forward to... I was looking forward to Masgar for a long time because I was a fan of the comic, and I actually... would go up to the artist at conventions and ask him when the RPG was going to come out, and there were some delays. And then I picked it up and have completely failed to play it so far, which is something I hope to change soon. But I think actually playing it may make it click more for me. I know that's your big thing now, is about failures and turning them into other things. I haven't quite gotten to the point where, at the very least, I can do that on the fly. But maybe after seeing the inspiration system in action, I'll be able to pick up on it more.
Yeah, hopefully I'll show it to you very soon. I've played it once yet as a DM, and it plays beautifully once you actually get what the game is about.
I picked up the book at Gen Con. I didn't buy it, but I was looking through it, and it's a beautiful book. It's a well-produced game, and I would love to give it a shot. I think if I tell my players, hey, we're going to play a game about mice, somewhere, they're going to sort of laugh at me and tell me, no, we're not. You are, we're not.
It doesn't feel like it, or it plays so naturally. The system fits so naturally, the fluff that the game's built around, that you just go along with it.
But how reskinnable is it? I mean, can you reskin it?
It's very reskinnable, and then the forums, the game's forums are full of ways of reskinning it with other animals or humans or whatnot.
Jedi.
Yeah.
That's cool. Jedi Guard. I'll play that.
Yeah, all right. All right, people, this wraps up our first show. I'd like to thank you all for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope to be able to produce such shows at once a month, and always with new ideas and new subjects and whatnot. So, tell us, Dave, can you give us a few clues as how it's going to work in terms of leaving comments and subscribing to the show?
Yes. So it will be hosted on critical-hits.com. There's a big old podcast button on the every page. So you can hit that, or it'll be on a drop-down menu that'll say Dungeon Master Guys. And we will set up a feed for it that you can subscribe to. And once this show gets on, we'll put it up on iTunes, so you'll be able to search for it there. So you can leave comments on the blog post that puts the episode up, and you can also email us. It goes to all of us, dmg@critical-hits.com.
And right. Don't forget the voicemail. You can call in and leave your comments, questions, and we'll tackle on the show as well. That's at 305-349-3026. It's 305-349-3026. We're paying good money for that line, so use it. That's an order.
All right. Well, thank you again, and thank you, guys. It was really fun. And this, we hope, is the first of many other such shows. On the next show, we're not going to reveal too much, but we're going to try to have a very special guest. So stay tuned, and we'll probably drop a few hints on Twitter and on the website. So, thanks for tuning in, and talk to you next time.